Hi, my name's Alex Donaldson, and I will be conducting this interview on behalf of the One Another Project and the Wellcome Trust. The date is the 23rd of August 2009. If you could please state your full name, your age, if that's okay, and where you're from.
Yeah, Julia Lane Candy, 29, Whitley Bay.
And how are you today?
Yeah, really good, very happy. Feeling well.
So, can I briefly take you back to when you initially heard about the project?
Gosh, it was when I first became aware of it, when there was the competition for those four different artists up for who was going to win. And I knew that Anthony Gormley was up for it. And I read all the different ideas and what his idea was going to be. And I kept hoping that he would win because I'm a huge fan of his work. And so that was when I first became aware. Then when he found out that he actually had won, that was great. And then so I was waiting, so I instantly signed up to the internet where it said then they will let you know when the application forms are coming through, and that's when I applied, the first day.
What was it that actually inspired you to put yourself forward?
Being from the North East, the Angel of the North is just, it just sums up what it is to be Northern. I remember when it was first seeing it on Look North, the idea of what was going to happen and the huge furore, but I instantly just, I saw, you know, what it would look like, and I was instantly fell in love with it. And then the day when he unveiled it, I was there because I had to go and see it. I was 17, and I just thought it summed up what to be Northern, because it was just looking out down to the south, and it was almost saying, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, because I just thought the Northeast has gone through such an awful time to suddenly have this great symbol of magnificence, beauty. Oh, and so just be part of anything that he does was why I got involved.
What is it about Anthony Gormley's work, do you think, that you love so much?
I was fortunate enough a few years ago to hear him give a talk in Durham about what he wants his work to be about, and it was all about the embodiment of, you know, of humans. And I just think we live in an age in which almost we've become so ashamed of our bodies, and he's almost celebrating the body, and it's just fantastic, this, that we are human, and we are embodied creatures. And I also, and why art's important with Anthony Gormley is, I think, because it's, art is all about embodying an ineffable, I'd say. And so, yeah, it makes sense.
And have you been following this project so far?
Yeah, oh yeah. And it's, I mean, the one that caught me the most was, it must have been about 4 weeks ago when a woman came and she just ironed. And I just thought that was just remarkable, because this, you know, well, obviously I'm going to do a big feminist reading onto it, going, yeah, because, you know, why there are, you know, very few great female artists in the past is because it's women doing domestic jobs. And so by taking these domestic jobs and seeing it as an art form, you know, it's putting the women's role there. Hardcore feminist.
You are yourself?
I think I am. I hope to be.
And is that always something that you've leant towards?
Yeah. I grew up in a household. I've got three sisters. And, you know, my father's never made a secret of it. He always wanted a boy. Because, you know, boys are far more rational and sensible. And so being a woman, I was just, you know, going, no, I can be just as, you know, dynamic, productive, successful. It's because, you know, I was born a woman, and also I don't need to play the male game either, you know. I hope in a more caring and emotional way, but I think I'm successful with it.
So could you talk a little bit about what you're planning on doing today?
So today, originally my plan was that I was going to wear very masculine clothes with a bowler hat and an umbrella and a briefcase and then sit and write. But on the train coming down today, I left my bowler hat and the umbrella on the train, and prioritisation being as it is, meant that everyone kept passing me on to someone else to find it, and no one knew where it was. And so in the end, did not to do so. I thought, oh gosh. So we were standing outside King's Cross Station, my husband and I, and I was going, I don't know what to do, it's going to be crazy. So I always knew I was going, because at the moment I'm writing a play, so I always knew I was going to write while wearing masculine clothes. But then, so I thought, oh, it's going to look crazy, it's going to be bare, it's going to be quite boring. And then I thought, let's, in my past, in my student days when I used to be far more, you know, far more of an activist, I always used to make placards for things. And I thought, I know, I'll make a placard, and I'll make a placard which at the moment I think sums me up is humanity is underrated. And so we went, so our in-laws drove us to home base, and this evening we made a placard saying humanity is underrated. And so I shall hold that probably every 15 minutes. I'm going to sit, just stand there and hold it, and then get back writing, and then hold it again.
And why have you chosen this slogan in particular?
We live in the worst age possible, where we've totally, what, you know, we all, I mean, one thing I'm really passionate about is mobile phones, that, you know, every, you know, it's the thing we always have to have and desire and that sort of stuff. But if we really thought about mobile phones, this is what's led to all the bloodshed in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And if we actually thought about humanity and we actually rated it, we'd give a lot more of a damn than we do about the world than we do at the moment. So it's that sort of thing. We've got to start rating it. And it's underrated, because I think humanity is the most amazing thing. And yet we give ourselves such a hard time about it. And we just think nothing's ever going to happen. I think things can change.
So when you say you feel strongly about mobile phones, can you elaborate on that?
I say mobile phone, it's just all these, we live in such a disposable culture, you know, whether it be, you know, cheap clothes made in sweatshops, whether, you know, we just care about the object. We never think about where it's actually being produced from. And I think it's that sort of, and a human life is suffering as a result of us in the West, having all these really disposed, you know, these things which we just don't even care about. Because, you know, if we have a T-shirt, it only costs £2. And so, you know, if it gets a stain on it, well, just bin it, doesn't really matter. And it's that sort of, there's, you know, some person there working so hard, awful conditions, getting paid such little money. We just don't give a damn about that person. And that really upsets me, and I think we've got to start caring about humanity.
And have you done any kind of work to promote this before?
Well, in the past, before I'm doing my current profession, I was a lecturer in psychology, and I did a lot of my work in Northern Ireland, and I said that my research was looking at the effect of the conflict and how it had the effect it has on children's upbringings in terms of their sectarian attitudes and notions of national identity. And I then, as a result of that, looking at this, I ran a youth group on the Shankill Road, which is very much a loyalist area and very poor area, and it was cross community. And also because at the moment we're having, you know, there's peace now in Northern Ireland, which is great, but it's all the anger has now been taken out on other ethnic groups there. And so it was deliberately shipping them in, and then just having a youth group where it's not like, oh, because, you know, it's not like, oh, let's meet this person from, you know, who's Chinese, but more just all doing youth group activities such as football and, you know, having fun. And so they meet each other and, you know, talking about, you know, who they fancy, rather than, oh, let's go meet someone else, or think them as other. It was very much seeing them as the humanity. And then the big change in my career is that I'm now trained to be a vicar in the Church of England. And one of the big things I want to do in the Church of England is, we all talk about bloody divinity, but we forget the humanity. And I think if we really did care about humanity, we wouldn't have the sort of attitudes that the Church has at the moment towards other humans. Because I don't think they're very godly.
So how did you veer back towards religion?
I was born religious. Well, I wasn't born religious, so, you know, I was born religious. I grew up in a religious household. At the age of 14, my father had a nervous breakdown, and things got very tough, and I remember thinking, well, where is God in all this? There is no God. So I became a militant atheist, really, really strong atheist anyway, and I was very, very interested in politics. And anyway, you know, member of the Labour Party, not anymore, but I was then. And you're very, you know, always campaigning. And then I went to university, and people would, you know, and I'd be there, you know, with my copy of, you know, Gandhi's Hind Swaraj and in one hand and the copy of the Communist Manifesto in the other. And just quoting from to people and arguing. And people would always say, you know, we agree with you, yes, but you're arguing from a Christian perspective. And that used to really, really bloody annoy me. Like, I'm not a Christian, how dare you say this? Anyway, but it kept coming back to me. So I started to go to church reluctantly, just sitting at the back going, well, this is all crazy. And then, you know, more, well, I thought, well, actually I quite like Jesus, you know, he's a bit of a radical, everything's great. And then the more and more I got into it and thinking about it again, I thought, okay, I have kicked out the baby with the bathwater, and that maybe actually I'm religious and we need to consider the spiritual dimension here. So I was born in the Church of England, and one of the reasons why I went to Northern Ireland, I thought, well, surely I'm only a member of the Church of England because that's what my parents were. And I thought, I know, I'll go to Belfast, I've got every single denomination going, I'll go to them all. And so every Sunday I used to just pick a church and go to it and just see whether it was me, whether it wasn't me. You know, I think all of them in a way embodied God, apart from I would argue Ian Paisley's church. I think having the big Union Jack and him just shouting didn't really help. But so I decided at the end, well, why I was an Anglican is because it's a broad church and there's all these different traditions in within it, and so I don't really need to say I am just this. So yeah, worked. Anyway, but I was very happy just being a Christian, you know, I think it was grand, happy in my job. But I kept having this nagging feeling, because it originally happened when I was about 14, that maybe I should be a priest. And that's when I became a militant atheist. I thought, God, this is just, you know, my father's having a breakdown. This is just a crux, you know, I need to feel a sense of belonging and there is no God. It just, you know, it's just this fictitious, you know, big dad in the sky. And so I thought, nonsense. But anyway, so I went back, became Christian again. And then against the sense of, I should be a priest. So I went then for all these interviews, and I kept hoping they would say to me, look, you're a really lovely person, but you're not a priest, you know. Just be a Christian and, you know, be a good person, that'd be fine. But everyone kept saying, yep. And then so I find myself, I'm training now.
You seem like quite a kind of theoretical, rational person. Do you think you can rationalise religion?
You can up to a point. My problem with religion at the moment is I think they kick rationality out too quickly. And rationality will take you to a point, and then you will get to a point, the ineffable, where you've got to say, we can't say any more, it's inexpressible. But the problem with religion at the moment is that they start putting words in there, going, well, if it's something is ineffable, if it's inexpressible, then why the hell are we putting in some doctrine there and saying it doesn't make sense? And so it takes you to a point. And I think there is this need, I think this deep need in humanity for, you know, spiritual dimension. And why though, you know, I'm not going to start saying Christianity is better than any other religion, you know, all the different ways of channeling into spirituality. I'm a Christian because I was born in Britain, you know, it's, you know, what I was brought up with, you know, so, you know, that's why I'm a Christian. But there is this great spiritual need, and while I'd say though major religions are better than, let's say, these sort of new age religions, is new age religions, they're very much about the individual, whereas I think what world religions, you know, all the great faiths, what they're saying is saying you've got to look beyond the individual to your fellow humans and how you care towards them, rather than just about how you're feeling, it's about how everyone else is feeling, if that makes sense.
How do you think Christianity has transformed your life?
It's given me far more questions. And I think it makes, the great thing about it is I think it should, and I think at times it doesn't, but I think it should breed humility and just a sort of a gentleness, I hope. And also at times though, when, you know, to be radical when you need to be radical. But there are issues which really need to be challenged. And I think it's telling you to turn over, you know, the money changers table and to shout, this is wrong.
So can I ask you a little bit about what you're planning on doing today?
So I'm planning on holding a placard saying humanity is underrated. I'm going to hold it probably for every 15 minutes for a total of 2 minutes. My husband thinks I'm being far too fascist by stating this. There we go. And then just sitting and writing a play I'm working on at the moment. And so I'm just looking, because it's already going, but I'm just hoping different lines come to me. So I'm not thinking, I think the lines that I write won't be straight dialogue. I mean, I might see characters saying them, but I'm just going to write them, and then tomorrow, no doubt when I wake up in the afternoon, fit them into where I think they would go. It's an amazing opportunity.
And ultimately, what kind of experience are you wanting to get out of today?
Quite selfish, really. I'm just hoping for some decent lines for the play. And also, I hope to get people, just thinking, they're going to see humanity is underrated. It's not been controversial. And I think hopefully they'll say, yeah, it is, and it shouldn't be, and we should do something about it. We should, start giving a damn about each other.
Could you talk a little bit about your play?
the play. So the play, it's, okay, last year I was in Genoa, and at this art gallery, and some beautiful pictures, of all these Renaissance artists, and it was all fantastic. And then I see this one picture, and it was of the Ark, Noah's Ark, and it's landed, and there's Noah's family, and all the animals are coming off, and then the place is just strewn with bodies. And then you think, bloody hell, of course. I mean, this is, we teach it as like some child's, nice story of all going on the Ark and all coming off. And it was just a genocide. And so what this play, it's five characters, and each one of the five characters are named. It's going to be set in this place. It's going to be almost like a church setting, very stark, and five characters. And they've all got names after Christian theologians who are also, in my opinion, anti-Semitic. And they're all going to be there, and we clearly know that something's happened. These five people have been rescued. But they're so busy just arguing about the service, about how what they should be saying to the great person who has saved them. And then these five people are coming off the ark, and eventually they come off the ark, and the stage will hopefully be strewn with bodies, and they'll be shocked and thinking about this. But in the end, they just continue going on talking about the service. And this, and why I'm doing this, is my reaction to the Holocaust, because the church, it's a history of promoting anti-Semitism. It still does, in terms of the biblical readings that we say and how we how we understand them. It's still extraordinarily anti-Semitic. The Holocaust has happened. The church, I don't think, really has reacted to this and changed the sort of service it should be doing and challenging it. And so it's hopefully going to be my voice against this, saying the church really does need to get its act together again.
And why do you feel so strongly about this particular subject?
It shocks me that the Holocaust could happen, that you can dehumanise someone so much that they make them not human. Commit such, an absolute atrocity. And it just, and then, and nothing's changed, because then, we see, back to, Sudan and Congo and, Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's just absolute carnage. This sort of thing, we just objectify humans. And what does the church do? The church argues about homosexuality, and it's like, and women priests. It's like, oh, come on. We really do need to change. I think the Western society really does need to change. We need to learn something from the Holocaust, and I don't think we have. That's the awful thing.
So what are the logistics of the play? Have you, how far along are you writing-wise?
It was far further than last week. I was far further until actually it was last Saturday when my laptop decided to crash, and there we go. But that's fine. Quite far, quite far. I mean, I promised myself that and a few other people, so then I will keep my promise. If it was just for me, I'd forget about it. But because I promised some friends, then they will force me to keep my promise. End of September, it will be finished. And then to go around trying to tout it. Whatever you do, I don't know.
And just to go back to your feelings on feminism.
Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about...
Oh, gosh. We live... Firstly, I'm aware of it, if it's in... It's terrible to people in my church. But in the church, being a woman... and their views on women priests. I mean, where I train, there are men there. Our chaplain there is a woman, a fantastic priest. I mean, she really is just a beautiful, beautiful person who won't accept her, who won't take communion, who won't talk to her because she's a female priest. And I just find that bizarre. That there is something lesser. You know, if she was a bad person, then, well, even then I'd say, you know, how bad can you be? But to treat someone like that, and that's within a supposedly Christian institution, offends me. But we also live in an age where women are just objectified so much, where it's about how much, you know, cleavage and, you know, constantly, you know, a male politician can do what he likes and be as ugly as he likes, you know, only if you're ultra ugly do they make comments. A woman, as a politician, all she'll get is abuse, you know, for not being this, not being that. Where they just won't accept her for her abilities and her talents. And so I just find it an awful, awful way for the woman to be like this.
And do you think that... with so many charities and so many people lobbying for the feminist cause, they are kind of gaining in freedom and.
I hope. Well, you always have to hope, and I think you have to hope. And I think the battle really is now. Because you know the middle-aged women and who are campaigning are just fantastic, so solid. It's for young women, you know. I had an argument with my niece. She's 17 now. Why Jordan is a great role model. And I was just like, you know, what is this? Jordan is a great role model. There are so many amazing women out there who are great role models. Jordan is not one of them. You know, anyone can take their top off, and anyone... can, you know, well, actually not many people could marry Peter Andre, they haven't got the stomach for it, but you know, they can do that. But actually to do something worthwhile, to really make a difference. But then I mean, the other day I was listening to this Radio 4 interview, and there was the most beautiful, beautiful woman talking. Her, you know, she's a Londoner, her son died at the Tavistock bombing in July. And, you know, he was only 26. And what does she do with this? She's got so much anger. Is she set up a charity in his name in order to encourage, you know, dialogue with religions. And it's just turning something positive. And I just think, you know, you're a role model, you know. You're a beautiful person.
And so just to go back to your hour.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about it?
Really, really excited. A bit nervous about the actual cherry pick of it. But standing there, it's going to be great fun. Yeah, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.